So for the last few weeks here at Weston, we have been walking through these stories of figures in the Bible, characters in the Bible, where God acts in sort of unexpected ways, right? Where God does things that just aren't what we would expect, where God uses people who we never thought God could use. So we started back in the book of Judges with the story of the judge Deborah and Barak and this woman who God raised up to lead God's people at a time when all Israel did as they saw fit and everyone acted however they wanted. We jumped ahead to the story of David taking on the giant Goliath. And we saw in that story a reminder that God gives us the strength we need to face those giants that we come into contact with in our lives. A couple weeks ago, we looked at the story of Elijah at a time when the kingdom of Israel has been divided into a northern and a southern kingdom, and Elijah is convinced that he is the only one left. He's convinced that there's nobody who can understand what he's going through, and Elijah goes and he needs renewal so much so that he sits under a bush and he prays that he would die. And we saw the hope that God gives us renewal, that God gives us a calling and an identity. And then last week, we jumped ahead in the story of God's people to the final days of the kingdom of Judah when Habakkuk, the prophet, looked around and saw all these things that were wrong in the world, and he said, God, how long are you going to let everything be so wrong? How long are you going to let bad things happen? How can there be a good God in a world that's so broken? Well, this week we jump ahead yet again. The kingdom of Judah has been conquered by the Babylonian Empire. And the people, God's covenant people, these people to whom God made the promise all the way back in history, he said, you are going to be my shining example of my love and faithfulness after generation of failing to keep the covenant promises that they were supposed to keep. God allows them to be conquered by the Babylonians and they go into exile. Now, the exile dominates so much of the biblical story of the Old Testament. A lot of the prophets are speaking to the people of Israel while they are in exile. There are psalms that are written after the people are in exile. There are entire books of the Bible, like the book of Esther, that are stories of what happens while the people are in exile. But the challenge is that as we, here in the 21st century, as we look at these stories of God's people in exile, I think what we find is we find these stories that are both familiar and yet also very foreign to us. All right, today we're going to look at the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's the sort of story that if you grew up in the church, you may have heard that story at some point in your life. You probably had a Sunday school lesson on it if you were a part of the church as a child. You might have even seen a version that involved vegetables called Rack, Shack, and Benny. And even if you didn't grow up in the church, there's a good chance that at some point you sort of came across this story of three guys who get thrown into a burning furnace. It's familiar. And yet the reality is that there's something so foreign about this story. And more broadly, there's something so foreign to us about this experience of exile. Because we don't have a framework, most of us at least, don't have a framework for what it means to be taken from your home and brought to somewhere new. Most of us don't have a framework for what happens when what has been sort of a homogenous culture of all people like you, and suddenly you're thrown into a world in which everybody speaks different languages and different, there's all sorts of religions all around you, and the world is much more complex. For the people of Israel who go into exile, this shakes their identity to the core, including how they worship God. Because while they lived in Israel, all of the worship of God, their communal worship of God, took place in the temple, in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, in the temple, was the place where one went if one wished to encounter God. But the temple is destroyed. all of its beautiful furnishings are taken away. And so, the question that is before God's people when they're wrestling with exile and what it means to be in exile, I would suggest the question is, what does it mean to be faithful in a world that is increasingly complex? Because that's what happens to these people of Israel when they go into exile. Their sheltered world of homogeneous people, suddenly they're surrounded by people who are not like them. Their worship of God that always made sense, and they had their patterns and they had their songs that they sang and they had everything that they knew how to do it, now suddenly they don't have that anymore. They've been brought to a new place, to a new environment, to a new situation, and the world is so much more complicated because now they are living in Babylon. And Babylon, as we talked about last week, Babylon is just the absolute picture of everything that is wrong with the world. And the reality is, as we're going to find out, some of these people, some of these Israelites who are now living in exile, they make it, they succeed. Right? Some of them rise through the ranks and become government officials in the government of the Babylonians. And it's complicated. What does it mean to be faithful to God when you're serving the government that represents everything that's wrong with the world? What does it mean to be faithful to God when you're living in the midst of this culture that's so broken? What does it mean to be faithful to God when you're surrounded by this picture that invites everybody to a life of excess? It's that question that, even though I might not have that experience of being taken from my home and brought somewhere new, it's this question: what does it mean to be faithful in a world that is increasingly complex? It's this question that I connect with. I'm part of that sort of sliver generation that really came of age with the internet, right? Our first family computer we got when I was in middle school. I was the one in my family who was on the internet before my parents were. When I was in high school, I was using MSN Instant Messenger and AOL Instant Messenger and all these other, you know, things that nobody uses anymore to connect with people from around the world. Right? We are in this period in history where the world has become more complicated and more interconnected at a faster pace than it has ever happened before. And for some of us, that's terrifying. Because we look at our kids or our grandkids and we go, what does it mean to raise kids in a way that they'll be faithful in a world that's so complicated and interconnected? For some of us, this experience is just everything we've known. Right? We grew up in it. And the idea that we can connect with anybody at any given moment is just part of the reality of the world that we know. We're not asking ourselves, what does it mean to be faithful in this complicated world? Because the world has always been complicated. The world is interconnected in new ways, in faster ways. We have access to every sort of information we could imagine or want in an instant. What does it mean to be faithful when the world is no longer as simple as it used to be? When our communities are a mix of people of different backgrounds and different walks of life, of different histories, how are we faithful? What does it mean to be faithful in a workplace that's connected around the world? We may not have been displaced from our homes, but I think we understand this question. What does it mean to be faithful in a world that is increasingly complicated? Well, that's the question that's at the heart of the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they start though, with different names. When we first meet Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Daniel chapter 1, they're known instead by the names Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now, the interesting thing about names in Hebrew is that names, they don't just mean something in the sense of like, Plockmeyer, I've been told, means peat cutter, or either that or royalty. I don't know. We haven't figured it out. So either my ancestors were really poor or they were royalty. Who knows? Right? But it's just what it means. It doesn't really matter. But in Hebrew, the name that you gave a child wasn't just a name. It was an identity. It was a calling. It was who you wanted this child to be. So I remember one time I was a campus minister at Michigan State University. We had a group of graduate students together, and there were several international students there. And we were talking about names and identity. And I asked everybody to share how they got the name that they had. Right? So my name is Corey because, well, my parents already had Kevin and Kristen. They needed a third K, and they liked the name Corey. So they went with it. But I remember there was another guy there. His name was Chidozie. Chidozie was from Nigeria. And he told this story that his parents had already lost a child. His older brother had died while he was still young. And so when Chidozie was born, his parents named him Chidozie, which means may God protect him. Because that was who they wanted him to be. That was what their prayer was for their son. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah mean grace. The one asked for, or an answer to prayer. And Yahweh helps. This is who they are meant to be. It's who they're being invited to be. It's who they are called to be. But when they're brought to Babylon, they're given a new name, a new identity. Hananiah becomes Shadrach, Mishael becomes Meshach, and Azariah becomes Abednego. And those names mean something too. Shadrach means command of Aku, who is the god of the moon in Babylonian mythology. Meshach means who is what Aku is. And Abednego means servant of Nebo, who's the Babylonian god of wisdom. In other words, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are called into this middle ground where they have two identities, and the question is, which identity are they going to live into? Which identity are they going to embrace? Are they going to be living embodiments of the grace of God? Are they going to be living proof that God answers prayer? Are they going to be living proof that God delivers us? Or will they embrace the identity of Babylonians? Well, eventually the challenge comes. The challenge, this opportunity to show who they're going to be. And it comes when King Nebuchadnezzar sets up an image of gold and asks everybody to bow down and worship it. Now, this seems sort of strange, right? The reality, and this is part of that familiar but foreign nature of the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because, well, I don't see many 90-foot-tall statues downtown Grand Rapids asking me to bow down and worship it. What we need to understand, though, is that this idea of setting up a statue for worship or for to be reverenced in some way is not a brand new thing with Nebuchadnezzar. The most famous example is the Colossus of Rhodes, which we don't actually know for sure what it looked like because it got destroyed a long time ago. But the Colossus of Rhodes was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world and was also about 90 feet tall. These massive statues were known in the ancient world. So when King Nebuchadnezzar sets up a 90-foot-tall statue, he's not doing something totally out of the blue. But he sets up a 90-foot statue made out of gold. Now, on one level, there is a threat and intimidation to this, right? There's an intimidation to this worship of the statue because he threatens, if you don't worship the statue, I'm going to throw you into the furnace. But I don't think his purpose is just to be a megalomaniac. I don't think he's just being driven by this desire for power. See, the Babylonians are actually quite effective and efficient rulers, right? Daniel, another Jewish person living in exile, has been appointed as a royal advisor. And it's by Daniel's instruction that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego become administrators. Because one of the things that the Babylonians know is that one good way to make a conquered people group feel at home is to put some of their own people in positions of authority. One of the things that the Babylonians are trying to figure out is how to rule in such a way as to not have rebellion everywhere they turn. And so what Nebuchadnezzar does by setting up this giant statue, this image of gold, it is a celebration of the power and wealth of the Babylonian Empire. Because that's what these statues are all about. They're a place to celebrate. Look how amazing Rhodes is, because it has the colossus of the god Helios. Look how amazing Babylon is. We have this 90-foot statue made of pure gold of King Nebuchadnezzar. So for all of these recently conquered people groups like the Jews, like the people of Israel, who have now been brought into Babylon, it's a way to say, look how wealthy we are. Look how much you can benefit from us. Because the Babylonians can offer wealth and status. It's an image of gold. And so Nebuchadnezzar sets up this giant statue and invites the people to worship. It's an invitation to experience the best that Babylon has to offer. Everything you could want. Wealth and status and power and riches. But it's more than that. The statue is 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, about 90 feet. But like names mean something, so too do numbers. Especially in Babylon, where you have an entire class of people called the Magi who study numbers and stars. And so when here are the people of Israel living in Babylon and there's this number about a statue 60 cubits high, I think it's not a coincidence that the temple that King Solomon built for the Lord was 60 cubits long. I don't think it's a coincidence that the temple that King Solomon built was covered with pure gold. In other words, when Nebuchadnezzar sets up this statue, that is an invitation to experience the best that Babylon has to offer. It's a close parallel to the temple. Because something is going to have the worship of our heart. We all worship something. Because something has the first place in our heart, whatever that is. Maybe it's that pursuit of wealth that has the first place in our heart. Maybe it's the pursuit of status and reputation that has the first place in our heart. Maybe it's the preservation of our family that has the first place in our heart. One of the things that I find really interesting with this sort of close parallel of the statue that Nebuchadnezzar sets up to the temple is that sometimes things can look right, they can be the right size, but they can be the wrong thing to worship. Maybe we have something that's first in our heart that looks right, it's about the right size. But it's not the God of the universe. It's not the God who created us. It's not the God who loves us and embraces us. Well, Nebuchadnezzar sends out this order that everybody should, when they hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipe, and all kinds of music, that they must fall down and worship the image of gold. Now, all of these different instruments, this would make a terrible orchestra, because these are not instruments that play well together. These are instruments that come from all over the ancient world. The zither is more of an Eastern instrument. The lyre is a Western instrument. The pipe is a Northern instrument. All of these instruments come from all over the ancient world, and now here in Babylon, they're all together inviting the people to bow down and worship the statue of King Nebuchadnezzar. Right? It's the same thing as the reason why the statue is massive and made of gold, because you have this auditory, this reminder that you can hear of just how wealthy and powerful and far-reaching the Babylonian Empire is. Because whatever instrument you can think of, wherever it's from, has all been brought into service of Nebuchadnezzar. Babylon has a certain allure in our lives. Because sometimes we are drawn to something that might look good, something that might feel good for the moment, something that we think will make us happy. Something that we think is going to give us meaning and purpose. And it invites us to fall down and worship. The Hebrew word for fall down here is nepalu. And it's a word that often means to fall down in battle. That is, to die in battle. We all worship something. And we are all tempted to put something else as the object of our worship besides the God of the universe. We might not have a statue of Nebuchadnezzar to bow down and worship, but are we willing to sacrifice our family on the altar of our work? We may not have a statue of Nebuchadnezzar to bow down to, but are we willing to spend our lives in pursuit of pleasure and things that we think will make us happy? We may not have a statue of Nebuchadnezzar to bow down to, but we may be willing to throw our neighbors under the bus so that we can succeed. We all worship something, and eventually it will ask us to fall down for it. It'll ask us to give more than we can give. Well, the story goes on from here, and the order goes out, and all the people worship, but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refuse to worship. And some of the other administrators and rulers of the Babylonian Empire find out that they are not bowing down and worshiping the statue, and they go to Nebuchadnezzar, and they say, hey, remember those guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? They're not worshiping the statue like they're supposed to. So Nebuchadnezzar says to them, is it true that you don't serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? And they reply to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it and will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he doesn't, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Now remember that in this time, at the time that this story takes place, there's no Instagram. There's no photos at all. There is no visual record, there is no proof that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have not bowed down to worship the statue other than the word of those who are jealous of them. It would be easy for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to get out of this. They could simply deny it's true and say, no, that's not true. We worshiped it. They could make excuses and say, well, Nebuchadnezzar, sorry, I didn't hear all of those instruments, so I didn't know that I was supposed to bow down and worship. They could have even said that they were too busy with work, right? Well, Nebuchadnezzar, I was too busy running your kingdom to take time out of my busy day to worship the statue. Right? There's any number of things that they could have said to get out of it, but they don't. When confronted with the opportunity to deny their actions, instead they affirm it and place their trust in God. But what strikes me about that is that they get to this point over the course of any number of actions. In other words, they refuse to bow down to the statue. They go to Nebuchadnezzar. They refuse to lie. They place their trust in God. There's a process of obedience. What does it mean to be faithful in an increasingly complicated world? Well, in the words of Eugene Peterson, it means a long obedience in the same direction. Being faithful in a complicated world means that we recognize that it's not just about that one specific moment, but it's about the whole set of decisions that lead to that moment and the decisions that we're going to make after that moment. What does it mean to be faithful in a complicated world? It means that we recognize that no aspect of our lives is out of God's purview. That the way that we interact with people online is just as important as the way that we interact with people face to face. It means that the way that we treat the person who's serving us our food at the restaurant is just as important as the way that we treat our boss at work. Because it's a long obedience in the same direction. And the invitation that God extends to us is to experience the fullness of life that He offers us, no matter where we are, no matter what we are doing, whether we are alone or whether we are with a group, whether we are with our family or whether we are with our friends. And to trust that God is with us, that God will be with us. To be living examples of God's grace, to be living proof that God answers prayer, to be living proof that God is our deliverer. Well, Nebuchadnezzar doesn't like their answer. So he commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie them up and to throw them into the blazing furnace. And those soldiers actually die as they go towards the furnace. But these three men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. And the word there for fell is once again Nepalu. Because they fell down, willing to offer their lives instead of to walk away from being faithful to God. We all worship something. And eventually it asks us to sacrifice for it. What does it mean to be faithful in a complicated world? It means that we're prepared and ready to put the love of God at the center of our lives. It means that we're prepared to be examples of grace, living proof that God answers prayer, living proof that God delivers us, even when it means sacrifice, even when it's hard. Because it will be hard. If our life of faithfully following Jesus never leads to conflict, we might be missing something. If our life of following Jesus never means that we look different from the culture of Babylon around us, we might want to examine ourselves if we have something else at the center of our heart. If we can follow Jesus and still pursue the status, the power, the wealth, and influence of Babylon in the same way as everybody else around us, it may mean that we'd rather fall down for the statue of Nebuchadnezzar than for the God of the universe. And that doesn't mean that status and power and wealth and influence are necessarily themselves bad things. But it's about asking that question of ourselves, where does my heart lie? What am I willing to fall down for? What am I willing to die for? We all worship something. And then the story takes this amazing turn. Nebuchadnezzar looks into the furnace and he sees four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed. And the fourth looks like a son of the gods. This is a really interesting moment in the story. In part because when Nebuchadnezzar looks and he sees these four men, he uses this phrase, a son of the gods. Now, in Jewish tradition, the fourth figure walking around in the furnace with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is the angel Gabriel. And that certainly could be the case. We don't know for sure. But there's a certain tradition in the Old Testament that I want to spend just a minute looking at. And that's these instances where somebody shows up that we just can't quite make sense of. So for instance, in Genesis chapter 14, Abraham welcomes a guy into his tent named Melchizedek, king of Salem, who brings out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram. And then he's gone. We meet Melchizedek in the span of like three verses, and then he disappears. All he does is he shows up with bread and wine. He's the king of peace, is what Salem means. It's weird. Or in Joshua chapter 5, the armies of Israel are about to march around Jericho and defeat it in battle, and suddenly Joshua meets the commander of the army of the Lord. And Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, "What message does my Lord have for his servant?" And the commander replied, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy." Now, on first glance, we say, well, that must be an angel. But we find out elsewhere in Scripture that angels never accept the worship of people, because they turn all of the worship over to God. But Joshua falls down and worships this being, this person who shows up out of nowhere. Or in the book of John, after Jesus has been teaching, John gives some analysis of what Jesus has just said and what's happened. And he goes back to the story of Isaiah. And he talks about what Isaiah said, and then he ends by saying, Isaiah said this because he saw Jesus' glory and spoke about him. In other words, there's this weird thing that happens several times in the Old Testament. And the word that theologians use for it is called Christophany. Christophany. And what that is when Christ, when the second person of the Trinity, when the Son of God shows up just for a moment. And it happens just a few times. And yet, John recognized that Isaiah wasn't just seeing the presence of God, he was seeing Christ. The writer of Hebrews recognizes that there's something about Melchizedek that's connected to Jesus. Jesus shows up just here and there in the Old Testament because that's what our wild, unexpected God does. The God who delivers us, the God who saves us, shows up. And Nebuchadnezzar looks into the fire and he sees a fourth figure who looks like a son of the gods. Now in Hebrew, the word that's usually used for angel is malach, but here that's not what Nebuchadnezzar says. He uses this phrase, son of the gods, which isn't usually used for angels. And in this grand irony, Nebuchadnezzar, who has set up this statue to be worshipped, Nebuchadnezzar, who is trying to draw everybody to experience the power and wealth and influence of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar actually gets it right, even as he's oh so wrong. Because he looks into the fire and he sees the Son of God. The Son of God who offers us deliverance. The Son of God who answers prayer. The Son of God who gives us grace. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. And the fire didn't harm them. What does it mean to be faithful in a world that is increasingly complex? For Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it meant being living proof. That God answers prayer. It meant being living proof that God delivers us. It meant being living proof of the grace and mercy of God. And when they embraced that identity, they met the very one who offers us grace and mercy. What does it mean to be faithful in a world that is increasingly complex? For Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it meant a long obedience in the same direction. Living faithfully, even when it was hard. Living faithfully such that when they met that decision point, the decision had already been made long before. Because they had already been faithful so many times that it was natural to simply live out of that faithfulness when they were presented with the ultimate moment of testing. What does it mean to be faithful in a world that is increasingly complex? For Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it meant placing the faithfulness of God central in their hearts such that they were willing to fall down and die for it. Friends, what does it mean to be faithful in an increasingly complicated world? I think we can ask ourselves, who will you worship? Or what will you worship? We all worship something. We all put something at the center of our hearts. What will be at the center of yours? Who or what will you fall down for? Friends, imagine what happens. Imagine what it would look like if we were all like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. If instead of choosing to pursue the status and power and wealth and influence and any of the other things that the world tries to offer us as hope, what if instead we pursued an identity that seeks first and foremost to be living examples of God's grace and mercy? What would we look like if instead of pursuing status and power and wealth and influence, if instead we did everything we could to be living proof that God answers prayer? What if we were living proof that our God delivers us? I think many of us have already seen what happens. If you haven't read The West End Window, I encourage you to do it. There's a couple of great stories in there of the youth group in Port Arthur, Texas. How they were able to be living examples of God's grace. how they were able to be living proof that God delivers us and saves us. I hope you see Sue Melema's story of walking through mire and having somebody come up to her and say, "Hey, you're the woman who does Kids Hope at my school. Can I have somebody meet with me?" Because that's what happens when we are living examples of grace, when we are living proof that God answers prayer, when we are living proof that God delivers us. We can expect that God is going to use us even as we're walking through mire. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were presented with the choice. Who were they going to be? Were they going to embrace their identity as Babylonians? Or would they be living proof of God's grace, living proof that God answers prayer, living proof that God delivers us? What does it mean to be faithful in a world that is always and ever more complicated? In part, we see from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that in part, it means that we embrace the identity, the calling that God has given us. In part, it means that we live lives of faithful obedience, a long obedience in the same direction. And in part, it means that we put the worship and trust of God first and foremost in our lives. Trusting that as God has delivered us in the past, as God has given us new life through Jesus Christ, that when we fall down for Him, when we give up our lives for Him, when we entrust our lives to Him, that He shows up and gives us new life, sometimes in ways we would never expect. Let's pray. God, help us. Help us to be faithful in this complicated world. God, help us to make decisions day in and day out, whether we're alone, whether we're with a group, whether we're online or whether we're in the physical world, that reflect the hope and promise that you give us. God, may our lives be living examples of your grace. May our lives be living proof that you answer prayer. May our lives be living proof that you deliver us and save us and set us free. God, may we offer that living proof to a world in need of hope. In the name of Jesus, we pray, and we all say together, amen.